Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Hello and welcome to Fat Mascara.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Jen.
I'm Jess. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm excited about today's episode. I feel like this week we're giving everybody like a good mix of like fun and service and information with our podcast.
Oh, yes, yes. If you're just jumping into this episode, the episode right before that we recorded a couple days ago was our Emily in Paris Jamboree.
Yes, exactly. And now we're going to get back into some science. So I'm in my happy place.
Oh, yeah. This is like where you thrive.
We have Dr. Susan Taylor, a dermatologist and a professor of dermatology at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. So I first met her years ago because she found, well, she's the head of the Skin of Color Society, but NBD, she also founded it. Mm-hmm. And that group has been such an amazing resource of news and information for Jess and I over the years. It's just, they put on these media events, they share information, they always have resources for you doctors to talk to if you're in the media. P.S. If I have any media friends out there, hit up Dr. Susan Taylor. Anyway, earlier this year, I saw her name on an academic paper she co-authored titled Multi-Ethnic Training in Residency, which was basically a survey of doctors in training. And they were asking about whether or not they felt prepared by their schooling and textbooks to treat patients with skin of color. What a fascinating topic. So Jess and I thought it would be really great to have her come on, talk about that, and also discuss other issues of systemic racism in the practice of dermatology. Just a side note, if you're interested in hearing more about skin lightening products, which is a topic we touch on here in the episode coming up, you might want to go back to episode 215. We also discussed this with Michelle Wong of Lab.
Yes.
Just like a little, an added something to this conversation if you want to hear more.
Yeah, right? This is why I think it's so important to get so many different perspectives on
exactly.
These topics. Yeah, there's no one definitive answer to these like really hot button topics. It's not like it is written. It's, you know, everyone has their own viewpoints. And that's what I love about the show.
Absolutely, Jess. You couldn't be more right. And we're really excited to hear Dr. Taylor's perspective. So here's the interview. Okay, so we're here with Dr. Taylor. Don't worry, we gave a nice bio on you before you came on the line. truly one of the most amazing dermatologists in the United States. Like, I'm so excited you're here. We want to hear about your career a little bit before we start talking about the issues of the day that we brought you on to talk about. So first off, what made you want to become a dermatologist?
Well, you know, when I went to medical school, I wanted to be an internist. And I wanted to treat people from the inner city with hypertension and diabetes and cardiovascular disease. But then during my fourth year of medical school, I did my very first dermatology rotation. And I loved everything about the specialty. The fact that patients could range from pediatric patients to, you know, those in their 80s and 90s, the fact that there was a little bit of surgery, there was pediatrics, there was cosmetic dermatology and general dermatology, the fact that you could actually see and feel and touch the pathology as opposed to like pretending you can hear it, you know, through the stethoscope. That really changed my whole focus. Now, when I graduated, I decided nonetheless to do a internal medicine residency. But halfway through, I said, you know, you've got to remain true to yourself. And what are you going to be happy, you know, 30 years from now practicing? So I went back and did another residency in dermatology, and here we are.
Oh, so that added a little bit of time onto your career, didn't it?
It did, yes. But it was so worth it.
Yeah. And so you, I know you're the founder of many amazing things that I've gotten many resources from. One of the things that you're known for is working at the Skin of Color Center. Can you, and you co-founded that, right?
I did, yes. So
tell us what that is and when that started.
Sure. Back in 1998, I did my dermatology residency at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. And about 10 years after I had finished, I got a call from one of my professors who said, you know, here in New York, there's the need for a center that specializes in skin disorders for people with darker skin tones. And he said, and this was my mentor, Dr. DeLeo, he says, you know, they say to me, you're a nice guy, but, you know, I want someone who looks like me. And so he called me one day and said, would you be interested in coming to New York and creating some type of center? And for me, it was an incredible challenge and an incredible need. This type of center didn't exist anywhere in the world. And my mandate was just to name it, to start it, to figure out what the mission was. And that was a wonderful, wonderful challenge. So what I decided was this would be a center for excellence in clinical dermatology. We would also perform clinical trials, research trials. And at that point, many dermatologists were very afraid of doing any types of cosmetic procedures on people with darker skin tones. So we wanted to really forge a path for that. So that's how we created the Skin of Color Center. I am delighted to report it's still in existence now. It's now affiliated with Mount Sinai, and there's a new wonderful director who's there.
Can I just ask Dr. DeLeo, was he a white guy?
Yeah, Dr. DeLeo.
I didn't know. You know, yeah. We're a podcast.
No, so Dr.
Black woman.
Yeah,
so no. Like,
Dr. DeLeo said, you know, I'm a tall white guy, and they don't want to see a tall white guy. They want to see someone who looks like you. And, you know, he's just been a wonderful inspiration over all of these years. And I'm very fortunate to have had him as a mentor.
Okay, that makes sense.
So when you left your medical residency, did you feel like you were prepared to treat all the patients that you were about to see? Yeah, so, and at the level of care that they deserved?
Yeah. So I had the distinct honor and privilege of doing my dermatology residency in New York City, in Manhattan, like one of the most diverse places on earth. So from the time I was a first year dermatology resident, I saw people with all skin tones and all ethnicities and racial groups. So when I completed 3 years of residency, I did indeed feel very prepared in diagnosing and treating disorders in people with darker skin tones. Then I opened up a private practice in Philadelphia, which is my hometown. And I found that over time, many women and men of color sought me out. Because, you know, it's not just the skin tone, but it's also the customs, the habits. Women did not have to explain to me what they do with their hair because I have the same hair. And so there's a cultural competence. And we wanted to create a center where all of the doctors, no matter what their race or ethnicity was, were culturally competent.
How do you think maybe cultural competence fits into like some of the textbooks that doctors use to learn about skin? And how do you think that these issues actually affect the health of patients in the long run? What is your take on this conversation? Because it really does start from like the education, doesn't it, that people like dermatology students receive and then bring into their practices. And then, you know, we see it in everything from like skincare products and, you know, the conversations mm-hmm. that Jen and I have right here on this podcast.
Yeah. So let me start by saying these are very important conversations to have. And I think we're very fortunate in 2020 to be able to have these candid discussions. I think in the past, many of the dermatology textbooks were centered around people with white skin, because that's what many of the training programs and many of our professors and the authors of these textbooks were exposed to, and they knew. But what we have found is that the demographics are changing, that there are many people of color, be they of African descent or Latinx descent or indigenous populations, that, you know, they're growing and there's a real need. And so I'm happy to report that in the last 5 years, 10 years, there are a whole host of textbooks that have been published that center upon individuals with darker skin tones, diseases that occur disproportionately in them, or present differently from someone with white skin. I'm also happy to tell you that some of the quote-unquote mainstream textbooks are indeed making sure they include people with darker skin tones to help dermatologists and residents and medical students be able to make the correct diagnoses. There have been a lot of discussion and literature and articles about this particular need. So I really see the tide turning. I'm very proud of the Skin of Color Society for all of their efforts, as well as the American Academy of Dermatology. So under the auspices of the American Academy of Dermatology, my colleague and I, Daniela Kaczynski, have started an effort to create a skin of color curriculum for dermatology residents. So we've been meeting with a group of dermatologists for the past 6 months, and we have made significant progress. And I think we are going to be able to launch this curriculum on skin of color to residents and then to medical school students in the next 3 to 6 months. And this has been entirely supported by the Academy. So this is just an example of the fact that our organizations have recognized the need to educate more broadly and are really mm-hmm. rising to the occasion.
Can I just ask you, Jess, I know you have another question, but before that, you said that some skin diseases and some skin conditions present differently in different skin tones. Can you just give us an example of that? Because, you know, we're not doctors.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you two examples of how skin diseases can present differently in darker skin tones. So let's talk about a very serious skin disease, melanoma. So that's the most mm-hmm. deadly type of skin cancer. On people with white skin, it appears on sun-exposed areas, head and neck, back. And in people with darker skin tones, it can appear on the palms, the soles, the fingernails, and the mucous membranes. So if you're not aware of that, you're not going to necessarily look at those areas. If a patient isn't aware that he or she, who's of African descent, can develop melanoma, they won't be on the lookout. They might think it's a fungal infection of their nail, for example. So that's an example of how a deadly disease can look quite differently. There's another rash that we see commonly, and you've heard of, eczema. So eczema, we think of as red, inflamed, itchy patches on the skin. Well, in people with darker skin tones, they can present as bumps on the skin. We call that the papular variant. And if you're not aware of that, you're not going to make the diagnosis as a physician. So a common disorder that presents differently mm-hmm. in people with darker skin tones.
So Dr. Taylor, I want to know, like, are there other ways that racism or, you know, I'm really obsessed with this term. cultural competence. I don't know if I'm
cultural using it. Incompetence. I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So please let me know if I'm using it incorrectly, because that would be embarrassing. Does racism or cultural incompetence pervade dermatology?
Other than like the textbooks?
Other than through academia.
So no, I don't think racism pervades dermatology, quite honestly. You know, I've been a dermatologist for 30 years, 31 years, and I would say no, absolutely not. That's not to say that some things don't need to be changed or, you know, need to be improved, but I don't think it's necessarily pervasive.
Okay. I hope you understand why we're asking right now. This is a hot topic.
So let me just say this. Let me say this. So one concern that all of us have, and we've really mobilized, is the fact that dermatology is the second least diverse specialty in medicine. And the only specialty that is on the bottom is orthopedic surgery. So that means in terms of what we call underrepresented minorities, URMs, and those would be people of African descent, Latinx, and indigenous. They have the lowest numbers in dermatology. There are now a multitude of efforts to address that issue and to change it. So for example, some of our leading derm organizations, the Society of Investigational Dermatology, the American Academy of Dermatology, the Women's Dermatology Association, the Derm Section of the National Medical Association. You know, I'm a little nervous. Oh, the Association of Professors of Dermatology. I don't want to leave anyone out. Have all come together to create programs to change this. So everyone is really working on it. At a level of the different dermatology programs, I'm at Penn, so we're looking at our rubric. How do we evaluate derm applications to make sure mm-hmm. we are considering the all candidates, no matter what their background is? So that's all to say, we still have a lot to do, but I think there's really a heightened awareness. Let me also say that COVID has made a huge difference for a number of reasons in changing and helping people to think about and address some structural racism. So, for example, we all know that people of African descent and Latinx are disproportionately affected by COVID, and some of that is probably related to them being first-line workers mm-hmm. And having multiple comorbidities. But in addition to that, COVID has caused most of this country to quarantine, and it has been at a time when there have been horrible murders in this country. And people have, for the first time, really paid attention to what's happening in our country. And that has really been a catalyst to make a change. For example, at Penn Medicine, centrally, there has been a request that every person in the medical center have unconscious bias training. And as of today, 1,000 employees at Penn Medicine have undergone unconscious bias training. And it's not just Penn, it's many medical centers.
Wait, just for our listeners, can you explain what unconscious bias is?
Yes, I apologize. So we...
And have you ever experienced, actually?
Well, we all have. We all have, yeah. Right? So unconscious bias are our biases that we might not be aware of, right? And they might be biases... they are biases against people who probably look different from us. So the test... There's a test called the Harvard Implicit Bias... Harvard Implicit Association Test. And what they do is they like flash these pictures and you have to pick, you know, you have a split second to decide, you know, what you prefer and you pick. And then they do an analysis, right? And they can say you prefer white people, you prefer black people or, you know, and it helps you be able to understand your biases. And they are built up from your family unit, how you were raised, et cetera. But the first...
Did you have biases when you took it?
I'm biased towards black people.
Okay.
That's my bias, right?
Well, you learned it in the training.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very interesting.
Right. So the first step, I think, to be impartial is to understand kind of where you're coming from. And I think that's really important for everyone. And then to learn about concepts like being an anti-racist, being an ally. So if you two, you know, observe someone saying something to me that's racist or a microaggression, you are my ally if you speak up and say, oh, wait, hold on a minute. That's not right. You know, you have really offended, attacked, you know, my colleague, Susan, based on what you said. And we should sit and talk about this and unpack this.
And this kind of training you weren't getting in the medical fields up until this year at like Penn, it wasn't necessary?
Well, I don't think many people were. I think many people weren't really aware of it, right?
Right.
So it's really been a real revolution.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
I That's great. That's great to hear. So Jess and I obviously work in the beauty industry. So we're on like the consumer side of what you do. Obviously, you're a doctor. And we've been noticing some changes in that world as well. So I wanted to ask you about like over-the-counter products and what's available out there. First off, like, is there really a difference if you're just looking for like a cleanser or a moisturizer? Does the color of your skin change what kind of product you should look for?
Well, so that's a complicated question to answer. Let me give you this example. I think in the world of beauty, and dermatologists are very involved in the world of beauty, maybe in a different respect, but in the world of beauty, we hear so much about anti-aging. Everything is mm-hmm. anti-aging, right? And anti-aging for the white population means wrinkles, fine lines, age spots, you might call them liver spots. Well, people with brown skin age as well, just very differently. So for example, instead of the liver spots or age spots, we will observe an overall darkening of our sun-exposed skin, the face or the V of the neck. So overall darkening, it can be an uneven skin tone, discolorations, all are manifestations of aging. So products that are going to address fine lines and wrinkles aren't going to be for me, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a sagging. I'm not going to have those wrinkles. Well, I got some wrinkles, but it's going to be loss of volume, a sagging. So it's good. That whole aging process is going to be a little bit different. And hence the products that I am going to benefit from are going to be different.
I was thinking, because my grandmother, you know, rest in peace, she's Puerto Rican and she didn't have a line on her face, not a line, but everything sagged. Yeah. and she got her skin tone got a little deeper in some spots. So then what do you think then about, and again, I'm bringing this up because, you know, for about maybe 4 or 5 episodes ago, I felt like we did maybe at least 3 or 4 news items just about brands that were taking products off the shelves or renaming their products that were brightening products that had just, I would say, blatantly problematic names.
Whitening in the name, even.
Yeah, and beautiful.
Exactly. Yeah. Fair and lovely.
Fair and lovely.
And, you know, they were designed to lighten the hyperpigmentation that you're talking about, but the names... So what are your feelings on those?
So there are two different issues when it comes to products to lighten or brighten the skin. It's been my experience that here in the United States, women want to return their skin tones to what they were born with. So if they have sun-induced darkening of the skin associated with aging, they want their skin to go back to what it looked like when they were 20, the same skin tone and hue. And they will use and embrace skin lightening creams. They will also utilize or come to a dermatologist for chemical peels, for example, because those procedures can lighten the skin. So that's one subset. Or let me just say, there are also patients who have acne and they have what we call post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, increased pigmentation after the inflammation of the acne pimple or bump have gone away.
Right.
They want to make that dark mark go away. Okay, that's one.
That's not why you were shaking your head. We're fine with this.
So
right?
That's one indication or set of indications for lightening.
Okay.
Unfortunately, in many countries, and I can think of some Asian countries like India, Japan, some of the African countries, a lighter skin tone is synonymous with better prospects of marriage, higher socioeconomic status. So those women and men want to bleach their skin so they appear lighter and hence can have more benefits, societal benefits. So that's though in those societies, we often see those products, you know, Fair and Lovely, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I think that's not so much the case here in the United States.
Are they the same ingredients, though? Like, I know you're talking about colorism, but Jess and I were like, you know, if you're using hydroquinone or, say, even, like, another brightening ingredient, isn't that the same ingredient in both types of products, or are they really quite different?
No, it can be. You can absolutely have the same ingredients in these products.
But they're marketed sort of differently.
They're marketed differently.
And if I'm understanding, I'm sorry, Dr. If I'm understanding, it's like... It's not the ingredient that's the problem. It's the marketing and the intent and the kind of the narrative behind it.
I would absolutely agree with that. Okay. Now, there's a whole nother subject, another discussion we can have, and that is some of the illegal ingredients in skin lightening products that can be quite harmful. So, for example, cortisones, steroids, very potent, strong ones can be included illegally in some lightening creams, and people can have quite dramatic side effects. We know that mercury can be included in some of these products with catastrophic results, you know, renal failure, et cetera. But that's outside the norm. These ingredients are banned. They're not approved for use in lightening creams. So, you know, I just want to mention it because that's a potential problem. But if you have a hydroquinone that is approved, in what way is it being used? So you're absolutely right. How is it marketing? How is it being used by the patient?
I understand.
And that's where we're seeing the changes this year, which are frankly long needed. Can we ask you about sunscreen too? I feel like this is another area that, I don't know, people of color have been underserved. Like the sunscreens leave such a cast on anyone like olive or darker, and it's still a problem. I know it's changing, but why do they do that, first of all? What's going on with the formulas? And, you know, like, is there any inherent problem in the way they're developed? Like, why haven't there been better sunscreens for people of color?
There are a couple
Taylor.
No, so there are a couple of ways to answer that question. It is generally agreed upon by the medical community that the most effective sunscreens are the physical blockers. That is the titanium dioxide and zinc oxide. So, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you'd see the person with a white smeared across their nose, right? That's titanium or zinc oxide. Then companies became much more sophisticated with their formulation and they made them micronized. So they broke them up into little tiny particles. Well, those tiny particles still created a white cast. But in an attempt to provide the most effective type of sunscreen, many companies have gone forward and continue to go forward with these micronized titanium and zinc oxide that still leave a cast. On the other hand, you have chemical sunscreens, and they perform better in terms of not leaving a terrible white cast, but, you know, it's a little bit controversial. People don't necessarily want to put chemicals, quote unquote, on their skin. The FDA recently published a couple of articles that demonstrated absorption of some of the chemical ingredients into the bloodstream. So again, that dissuades some people from utilizing it. And then in a certain respect, our hands are tied, meaning the manufacturers of sunscreen, their hands are tied by FDA regulations. In Europe, where there aren't the same regulations, or there broader, many of those sunscreens are beautiful and are aesthetically pleasing. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to be able to go to Europe from time to time, and I stock up on sunscreen, their sunscreens.
Because they don't leave A residue is what you're saying.
Correct, correct. But they have so much more leeway in terms of the regulations.
Yeah, they have Tinosorb. They have all the good sheer ones.
That's right. They do. Yeah. So I can't put all of the blame on the companies. I think their hands are tied in many ways.
So can I ask you more broadly, we're not going to get the sunscreens for a little while, it sounds like, but more broadly speaking, what are some of the biggest improvements in products for skin of color, you would say, in the last 20 years or so?
Well, I think that many cosmetic companies are now thinking about the consumer with skin of color and meeting her needs and are doing focus groups. And instead of saying, okay, we have XYZ product, how can we now market it to people with darker skin tones? Instead of that, they're saying, let's find out what the needs are and let's build new products based on that. I think one really concrete example are now the numbers of shades of foundations, which, 30 years ago, there were like four or five shades. But now, each company might have 20, 30, 40 different shades that match the skin hue. So that's a huge, huge development. I think of MAC. Many Black women love MAC. Why do they love MAC Cosmetics? Because they can find a shade that matches their skin tone. And, it doesn't have to necessarily be a high-end brand. Avon does a great job in matching skin tones. So I think that's a huge development in the last 20 or 30 years. Let me also give you another example. There have been a couple of studies recently that have demonstrated the importance of not only blocking UVA and UVB light, but visible light, particularly for people with darker skin tones who have melasma or post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, two common causes of darkening of the skin. And now companies have formulated tinted sunscreens that block visible light. And so there is much more progress in terms of basic science that then translates into over-the-counter products.
So I have to ask then, sounds like you have some favorites. What do you personally like to use? Like, what's in your skincare cabinet?
Oh.
Some Avon and MAC foundation, obviously.
So I'm also very fortunate in that, I get samples and I love to try things. So, my cabinet is kind of obscene, I got to tell you.
So what are like some of your sunscreens, for example? Because a lot of my friends with darker skin are always like needing sunscreen recommendations.
Yeah, so they range from Neutrogena has an SPF 55 that goes on pretty sheer. Anthelios, which is at a higher price point, has a milk that goes on pretty sheer and is not too sticky. So, you can get sunscreens at different price points. Also, what I might think goes on in a sheer fashion and isn't sticky, someone with a different skin tone, darker skin tone, might not agree. So, some of it is trial and error, right? Trial and error. But I just want to point out that you can get great products at various price points. And it's a matter
of... Of preference. Yeah, we talked about anti-aging a little bit. What are your... Do you use over-the-counter topicals? Or are you like prescription woman?
No, I think there is an important role of exfoliation with alpha hydroxy acid products, glycolic products. And there are a couple Avon products, and there's one called Ultimate Supreme. Oh, let me just give a disclaimer. I have done work for those companies in the past, all the ones that I've mentioned.
Okay.
So they...
Spoken like a true academic. Well, I like it.
Well, it's true, right? So, I was talking about the new products by Avon that have glycolic acid that are great for exfoliation. They're not too aggressive. SkinCeuticals, a different price point, has several products that are great for discoloration. There's a discoloration defense. They've got some great antioxidants and vitamin C products, a serum with vitamin C and ferulic acid. I love that.
Oh, you like CE ferulic?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. They have a hyaluronic acid cream. So there's a great cleanser that I use. It's in my bathroom now by Skin Better Science. You know, I even like Aveeno Clear Complexion Foaming Cleanser. Really simple. There's a Neutrogena Grapefruit Exfoliating Cleanser. So it doesn't have to necessarily be fancy or really expensive. Mm-hmm. It's what works for your particular skin.
It sounds like you have an epic medicine cabinet.
It's fun.
I like that you aren't just about the fancy products. That's really about all price points.
Oh, absolutely.
It's very reassuring.
Some of the best products are, relatively inexpensive, So I also am quite familiar with Cetaphil, CeraVe, Aveeno. Great price points, great, really good products.
Yeah, for sure. So before we let you go, we're going to lighten things up with a little speed round of questions.
Uh-oh.
Just to get, just so our listeners can, get to know the real Dr. Taylor,
taking off the white jacket.
Yeah.
She just stuck her tongue out at us.
So... this is just quick round, lightning round. What is the first beauty product you ever fell in love with?
I'm old, girls. I can't even remember.
You don't look old.
Okay. So when I was a kid, really for a moisturizer, we had Vaseline Petrolatum.
But, there you go.
But then there was a lotion that came out that was transformative for me. It was Vaseline Intensive Care Lotion.
Oh,
and I had exceedingly
like
dry, ashen skin. And I would, my mother and grandmother would give me these lotions and they'd say, why didn't you put your lotion on? Well, I did until Vaseline Intensive Care Lotion came out.
And did you use it on your body and your face or your body or?
Head to toe.
Everywhere? Okay, who is a celebrity that you just know you would be best friends with?
Beyonce.
That was so quick.
Of course.
Okay, what is your most favorite indulgent snack? And please be specific.
Okay, so I love, love, love chocolate chip ice cream by Springer's. Springer's Ice Cream Parlor is in Stone Harbor, New Jersey, and they have the best ice cream anywhere in the world.
I don't know it, but I feel like people who know Springer's are probably screaming right now listening.
There's always a huge line in front of it.
Sounds good right
now. There was a great place on the Left Bank in Paris that was pretty good, but Springer's is even better.
The ice cream in Paris was better than Springer's?
No,
no, other way around.
Oh, yeah, duh, sorry. This is my brain's not great lately. Okay, so what is the song that pumps you up? What puts you in a really good mood?
Oh, God. You know what? It's so funny you ask because I was there's a Beyonce song I was trying to remember today. And I'm just...
Oh, Love on Top.
Love
does
on
it for
Top.
Because it's just and every... She goes up higher and higher, and you're like, can she do it higher? I love that song.
Everybody.
And the band in the background.
What's not to love?
I didn't think that was going to be your song, but I love that you knew it. Okay.
All right. What do you want to raise a wand to? And this is just what are you obsessed with right now? What do you love? What could be a TV show? could be a beauty product, could be a movie, could be anything.
Book.
I love HGTV.
Oh, HGTV.
I know, that sounds
so comforting.
That sounds really like, really? She loves H. I love HGTV.
No, I get it.
You know,
I get
it. At the end of the day, after all the problems of the world, you know, have descended upon you, there's nothing like turning it on and seeing a beautiful home or a beautiful redo or a wonderfully gifted interior designer. And it's kind of fun.
It's soothing, right? Yeah, comfort. I get it.
Yeah.
This was great, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you
for sharing all your knowledge.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was an amazing discussion. I cannot wait to bring more people onto the show to continue this discussion because, like I said, I thought her perspective was really interesting. It was very nuanced, and I was surprised by parts of it. So,
yeah, such a scientist. Like, she came at it with, like, a data-driven mind that I just found really interesting.
And she was also really great to talk to.
Great FM5.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I really liked her.
Yeah, she was awesome. So, anyway, thank you so much, Dr.
Taylor. Thank you, Dr. Taylor.
Okay, let's get to the Razor Wand. Can I start?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course. Go ahead.
I wrote about this brand, Fluide, for my gender... I would say my gender... I don't want to say genderless. I hate these kind of like these catchphrases.
Yeah. Non-binary.
Yeah, it's just like they all sound like marketing terms. But I wrote a story for Bazaar about how the beauty industry is no longer looking at gender in a very, you know, binary way. And one of the brands that we included was Fluide Beauty. So definitely check them out. They are vegan, cruelty-free, all that good stuff. And one of the things I love about them is they're very affordable. So a product that I am loving is this little crayon that they have. And it's called a Universal Crayon. And I love this kind of rose goldy color called Rose Rover. And I'm using it today on my eyes and my lips and my cheeks. So if you like a kind of this, you know, you're doing this monochromatic looks that are like, well, how do you really do that without looking like muddy, you know, or just looking like you're not really wearing makeup? I love this because it has a little bit of like dimension and I don't say sparkle, but like a glimmer in it that it doesn't look like you're just wearing like, great, now you look kind of like muddy or nothing's happening. It's a really pretty crayon. It's moisturizing.
Is that what's on your cheeks right
yes.
now?
Mm-hmm. My cheeks, my eyes,
yeah,
and my
like
lips.
A gleam.
It's a gleam.
I wouldn't say glimmer, shimmer, a gleam.
A gleam.
Yeah. Gorgeous.
Thank you. And again, $12. Check it out. Fluide Beauty, FLUIDE.US, actually. Wow, US. It's one of those. I get no money for recommending it. I'm just really obsessed. I mean, that's the thing with all of our Razor Wands. I don't know why I said that. I guess it's because I spelled it out and that's what we do with
the show.
Yeah. That's what we do when we do the ads where we spell them out. So I was like FLUIDE.US. So check it out. I'm really into it. Fluide.
Hashtag not an ad.
Not an ad, just a fan.
Jess is just giving you lots of information.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I am a fan of Mona Lisa Pure Oil. So this is somebody, I met the brand owner via Instagram.
Yeah, I don't know
and
this.
And I said,
Mona
sure.
Lisa Pure
new,
Oil.
New fragrance? Of course I'd like to try it. So I tried it and I liked it. And she had given me two samples. So I also gave one to my best friend, Jess, the other Jess
other
who
Jess.
Lives in Philadelphia. And I really liked it, but then I was like, I don't know. There's not that much to it. It's a very simple scent. She called me to rave about it. She's obsessed with it.
I love that.
So I wore it again a couple more times, and I was like, she's absolutely right. So first of all, it's an oil, not an alcohol-based spray. There's no alcohol in it. So it just sort of like stays on your skin and in your clothes and just sort of like gives you a scent. It is one of these skin scents that I love.
Okay.
Where it just, you smell like you, but better. If you are not a perfume person and you're looking for those kind of scents, you know I have a couple other favorites. This is my new fall skin you, but better scent. It's amber resin extract and sandalwood oils, but it does not smell woody. These are some of the ingredients that are used in musks.
Mm.
Like things that you think of like a skin musk will often have these kind of ingredients in it. But because she put it in a oil form, it just, I feel like musks and ambers when they're in oil smell different, like better, don't you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm no perfumer, so I hope nobody no perfumers are laughing when I say this, but I'm like, I feel like it like hangs on to the skin. Like it.
Yes. It, yes.
Exactly. It's got more grip. I'm sure that's exactly what Frederick Malle would say.
I wish we had like a video so you could see my friend Jess, like using her hands to explain how it just like envelops you in a cloud of like yourself. It's so beautiful. Anyway, also vegan and cruelty free, which we love. Free of alcohol, phthalates, paraben, SLS, silicone. So if you like to check all those boxes, this is for you. So it's $40 for a 10 ml dropper, which looks really small on the website. Of course, I did the math for you guys. That is 200 drops of oil. You really only need like two, but like you're going to get obsessed and just like kind of bathe in 4 to 6 per day. But even still, that little tiny vial then will last you a month or two. And of course, you can buy a larger bottle if you like. It's gorgeous luxury skin scent for anyone who's just like, I want to smell like me, but better.
I love that Philly Jess loves it. I want Philly Jess to come on and do fragrance reviews. I love it. But we need video to see her explain it.
You think my accent is bad?
I don't think you have a bad accent at all. Are you talking? Look at me.
Well, yours is Jersey, mine's Philly, but when listeners are from the Philadelphia area, they always say they like listening to me because they hear Philadelphia. Oh my God, just give me a beer and forget about
it. Oh my God.
My accent is so thick. Anyway, and hers is like that all the time. She drinks water.
Oh my God.
Do you know what that, not H2O people, water.
Oh boy.
That's how they say it in Philly.
Oh boy.
Anyway, okay. I have a whole story about that for another time. Get some Mona Lisa oil, put your little fluid stick all over your face and have an awesome weekend. We'll see you next week.
See you next week, guys.
We hope you enjoyed the show. It's your reviews and feedback that help us make the podcast even better. Head over to iTunes to rate and review us or email your thoughts to info@fatmascara.com.
We also want to answer your beauty questions and hear what products you love. To share a Raise a Wand product review or to ask a beauty question, email us at info@fatmascara.
If you send it as a voice memo file, we can even share your voice on the podcast. You can also do that by leaving us a voice message. Our phone number in the United States is 646-481-8182.
Thanks so much for listening.